A Bug's Life with Theo Evans.
Theo Evans is back. He, of course, is our Associate Professor of Applied Entomology at the University of Western Australia. He has taken us in the past few months on a wonderful journey through the world of insects. Tonight, we have arrived at the locust. Hello, Theo. Welcome back.
Hello, Suzanne. Lovely to be here.
Now, I should say, Theo, we're probably only going to do a few more of these chats, and we are keen to make sure, aren't we, that if our listeners have a burning suggestion for an insect that we haven't covered yet, we do want to hear what they might be.
Yes, I'm curious. There's a huge diversity of insects. They are the most diverse group of animals in the world, so I'm sure there's a few out there we haven't covered.
Okay, so if you've got an insect that the whole time you've been thinking to yourself, when are they going to do this one? Text me 0467 922 702, and we might wrap up with a people's choice insect at the end of our series with Theo. But Theo, locusts tonight, they've got a pretty bad reputation generally, don't they?
Yes. I mean, when we hear the word locust, we normally think of a terrible pest, insatiable appetite, huge numbers, gigantic storms. Yeah, they are generally considered just bad guys.
Okay. All right. Now, what are they exactly?
Well, a locust is a particular kind of a grasshopper. Grasshoppers that have got quite short antennae, or short horns, we can sometimes say. And a locust is a subset of grasshopper. So most people know of grasshoppers. They eat grass and forbs in grasslands. So these are habitats dominated by grasses, not many trees, mostly because they are relatively arid. There's not enough water to support trees. But they also hop, of course. They jump around. They've got these really large back legs, and they use them to hop, and it's an escape from predators. It's a very good adaptation.
And they're fairly diverse, right? There's a huge amount of species of grasshoppers.
Yeah, so compared to beetles and butterflies and flies and things like that, not so much. They all have over 100,000 species. But amongst sort of the other groups of insects, they're pretty good. It's 20,000 odd species, which is multiple times more than most other species. So, yeah, they are pretty diverse. And we have species that live up in trees, in forests, as well as things that live underground in deserts. So grasshoppers is the standard, but there's quite a lot of diversity within that.
Now, you people, as in you Western Australians, Theo, you get called sandgroper from time to time. What is a sandgroper? Is that part of the grasshopper family?
It is. They are highly modified insects. And you know, this is one of those state-based nicknames people got 100-plus years ago. They're called sandgropers because they live underground in sandy soils, thus sandgroper. And their forelegs are adapted for digging. They're short and stumpy. And if you dig them out of the sandy soil, they usually wave these little stumpy legs around like they're groping, which is their action for digging. And that's why they get their name. Now, they're pretty common in WA, and they're pretty diverse. There's 13 odd species of, depending on a couple of definitions, of sandgropers, and six are in WA. And 11 of them are in Australia. There's one in PNG, and there's one in Argentina, of all places, which shows you that Gondwana link for when all of those southern continents used to be connected together. And, I mean, I think it's quite charming that our state nickname is that of an insect, but I don't know if everybody else feels the same.
But how did the West Australians actually become to be associated with the insect? I mean, obviously they're found there in Western Australia, but why of all things do they go, oh, these little insects that look like they're groping when we hauled them out of the sand? Was there a time when they were so, they were everywhere and people were talking about them constantly? Do you know much about that?
I think that's right. So WA has sandy soils, especially around Perth and the Swan River coastal plain. And these little crickets eat the roots of grasses that grow on those sandy plains. And when Europeans first came to Western Australia, they started to try to grow things in this sandy soil without any success. It's terrible to try to grow anything on. And it was a really different experience to the southeast of Australia, from Brisbane through to Melbourne, across partway to Adelaide, but not so much, and in Tasmania. where it's wetter, colder, and muddier, not as much sand. And so there are no sand gropers at all in that southeast part of Australia. So when people came to WA, it was a completely different beast, pretty common. No one could grow crops. It seemed to be a pest because it would eat the grass roots. And so it was a bit of a curse in the early days of the Swan River colony.
All right. Now, I know we're totally off the topic of locusts at the moment, but are they common to see? If you come to Western Australia, how likely is it that you can actually come across a sand groper and see it in action?
It's around, but you know, obviously we've built an awful lot of houses and there's a lot more watering. There's a lot more exotic trees growing in Perth. So if you find an area of natural grassland and you're looking in winter, because when the rain soaks in the soil, it starts the grasses growing. That actually wakes them up. They hibernate through the summer, or estivate is the right word, through the summer. And so if you've got a spade, you can look for these raised lines underneath the soil surface. They make a little humpy line as they push their way through the soil. And if you see any of those lines in a grassland in winter, you can usually dig just a couple of centimetres and you'll find them.
Put that on the list of things one must see in Australia, the sand groper in Western Australia. Now, Theo Evans is here, Associate Professor of Applied Entomology at the University of Western Australia. It's a bug's life. We're actually talking locusts, although we've diverted a bit. So let's get this clear. Crickets, of which sand gropers are part of that family, are a relative of grasshoppers, and are locusts part of, and locusts are part of the grasshopper family. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. So we can kind of think of crickets as having long antennae and grasshoppers as having short antennae as a kind of a easy demarcation between the two groups.
Okay. So where does the name locust come from?
It's from the Latin locusta, and curiously, it means locust, but it also means lobster. So I guess to the ancient Romans, locust was kind of like a lobster.
All right. We'll leave that for the ancient Romans to defend, perhaps. Okay. So how are locusts different from their grasshopper relatives?
They've got a special trick. They have two developmental pathways. So standard grasshoppers just have a standard development. When eggs hatch, they turn into nymphs. And in the insect world, we call a baby insect that looks pretty much the same as the adult a nymph. If they don't look like the adult, if they're sort of a wormy grub thing, then we call it a larva. And so they don't go through a full metamorphosis where you go from the caterpillar to the pupa to the winged adult, like in a butterfly. The juvenile nymph just kind of gets bigger and the wings slowly appear on the outside of the body. So regular grasshoppers just grow up in one straight developmental pathway. Locusts have this trick where they can just have the regular developmental pathway and they'll turn into something that looks pretty much the same as a normal grasshopper. But under special conditions, they can go through a second developmental pathway where they sort of get into a turbocharged locust body shape, which means they've got longer wings, bigger flight muscles, longer legs. They're basically evolved for long distance travel.
So do you mean there are two types of locust, regular locust and like a super locust?
That's right. And so under normal conditions, when there's enough food, they don't need to travel because there's enough food for them to live in that location. When food is getting scarce, they need to travel to find a new location to find new food. And so really it's about the sort of population density of the locusts as they're growing up relative to the amount of food they're all living on and in and eating. And this is triggered by little hairs on their back legs. And regular grasshoppers don't have these hairs, only the locusts do. And essentially, if they're all crowded in together, these little hairs get pushed a lot. And the more these little hairs get pressed, if it exceeds a critical limit, it releases hormones, which then turbocharges these locusts into these super travel locusts. And this is usually because of these weather changes in these semi-arid environments. You know, everybody knows what it's like in Australia. We either get droughts or flooding rain. And so when there's a, in 1 year, when there's a good amount of rain, the grasses will respond. They'll grow really well. There'll be lots of food. And so the locusts that year can lay lots of eggs. And then the following year might be a dry year. And so all those baby locusts come out and there's not so much food because there's not as much rain. So they all crowd in on the same bits of grass. Those little hairs on their legs all get pushed as they jostle each other around. And that triggers the turbocharged growth to become the travelling locust.
My goodness. And so could you have, say, in a big family of locusts, some of them get to be regular locusts, but some of them, they get their hairs get pressed and they become super locusts?
That's exactly
right. So I'm going to call them super locusts. I really love that. Doesn't sound scientific, but I really like the idea. So, and can it happen at any time during their lives? Do they have to be a certain age? I mean, is there a point at which, yeah, I'm too old to become a super locust, or can it happen at any moment?
It has to happen relatively early in their life. So as they grow, their wings grow with them. So if they get through to their sort of teenage period, if they haven't had that little hair pressed enough times by the time they're a teenager, they don't have enough growth left in their bodies to get the super wings and the big flight muscles and so on. And so they're just going to end up being a regular locust. So you've got to get them young.
Okay. And so does it give you other powers other than you've got stronger legs and so you can go flying off in search of new pastures? Do you have any other super skills?
Well, they actually have a wanderlust. They actually want and need to move, and they also become very gregarious. They're kind of forced into being gregarious because they don't have a lot of food, so they're all squashed onto the same plants. But even once they start travelling, they become adults and they've got their big wings and their big flight muscles and long legs, they like travelling together, and that's why you get these enormous swarms. So big travellers, but also very gregarious travellers.
Okay. Now, if I had like a super locust and a standard locust in my hand, could I tell the difference easily?
Yes, you could. The wings are sort of 30, 40, 50% longer. Legs are longer. The thorax, the middle of the body, which holds the flight muscles, is much thicker. It's an obvious difference.
Wow. Theo Evans is here, Associate Professor of Applied Entomology. So if I see the big locusts emerging or appearing in giant swarms, that means there wasn't enough food somewhere else and they've all gone, hang on, we got to go find some food somewhere else. And off they've all travelled together, and that's why they're embarking, you know, they're turning up at my place.
And when they turn up in the millions or billions and even occasionally in the trillions.
Oh, goodness me.
So it's really an extraordinary thing to see. If the listeners would like to have an idea of this, they can just Google a locust swarm, and there's plenty of images out there on the internet showing these clouds of billions of insects flying across the landscape.
Yeah, I'm sure most people who live in a rural or regional area have experienced the locust swarm at some point. Do you get them in Tasmania, locusts?
No, you really need a sort of tropical to subtropical, so quite warm and semi-arid environment. So all continents around the world that are in that sort of semi-tropical and semi-arid band around the world, North and South Hemisphere, will have locust species of one kind or another. We've got three in Australia that form these enormous swarms. There's quite a few in Africa, north and south of the equator. They appear in India and Pakistan. They also appear in the dry parts of the US, in the southwest and into Mexico, and in parts of northern Argentina. All different species, but all do very similar things.
And is this right? They are the only insects that have government agencies that monitor them.
That's correct. Because they form these spectacular billion to trillion sized swarms that can literally eat farms out in a day, they can destroy the crops that are going to feed a country within days to weeks. And so they are hugely important in their habitat. And so governments monitor them. They will have people on the ground that are checking for when eggs hatch to get an idea of how many baby juveniles appear. And once they grow up into adulthood and they start flying, these swarms are so big and dense you can detect them with radar. And so big countries, big and wealthy countries like Australia, we have our own government agency called the Australian Plague Locust Commission that monitors locusts in semi-arid areas to see if a swarm is going to appear. In Africa, we've got multiple agencies that cross multiple countries because obviously there's lots of little countries all joined together, and they have to act fast. As soon as it looks like a swarm might be forming, they need to know as fast as possible so they can deploy control methods so that they don't, these swarms don't get out of control.
It's A Bug's Life. You're on Nightlife with Suzanne Hill. Now, Theo, what can we actually do about the locusts? How can we try to control them?
So there's two main ways to control them. The first is spraying an insecticide, and this can be done in usually light aircraft. You fly on and around and over the swarms and spray an insecticide. You can also do this from the back of pickup trucks. You can have a fogging machine that you put inside the tray of the pickup truck that uses a lot of air and it forces the insecticide up. But we also have come up with a biological control method. So the problem with the insecticide is it'll kill the locust, but it'll also kill everything else, all the other insects around. And CSIRO developed a entomopathogenic fungus called Metarhizium. Entomopathogenic means insect killing. So the Metarhizium is a fungus that attacks insects. And you can grow this in a big vat in the lab. And you can get the conidia, which are the contain the spores, the reproductive spores of the fungus, and you can mix that into a liquid, and you can then put that, mix it with air, and make a fog, an aerosol spray, and you can spray it just like an insecticide. And so this can then be sprayed, and is in Australia. We use this a lot. It's also used elsewhere in the world. So that way you're just spraying this fungus that's just going to get onto the locusts and kill the locusts, and it means other things won't be affected by the chemical.
Have we had any luck using these kinds of methods at suppressing the overall numbers of locusts in Australia? I mean, is it less of a problem now than it might have been 50 years ago?
It is. So, but that's just because we have these government agencies constantly monitoring the populations, always looking for something that might be an outbreak and responding really quickly. And because these they start outside of farming areas, they start in sort of natural desert areas in Australia, we really need a government agency to do this. You know, individual farmers can't do this on their own. The issue is too big. It's too expensive to respond to. And that's why governments take it over.
Wow. Okay. So there, that's what's happening more or less now. I don't know if there's many locusts around at the moment, but obviously locusts have been with us a long time because biblical plagues often refer to locusts. So how far back in the Bible do they go, Theo?
Well, the second book in the Bible is the book of Exodus in the Old Testament. This is mostly about how the Israelites who were slaves in Egypt got freed by Moses and they got led to the promised land. And Moses kept going to the Pharaoh and saying, "Set my people free." And the Pharaoh kept saying, "No, go away." And every time that happened, God would then send a plague to punish the Egyptians. And the eighth plague was the plague of locusts that came and ate every green plant in Egypt and thus destroyed all the crops. And but that wasn't enough to set the Israelites free. There was, you know, another two. And, of course, the last plague was the death of all the firstborn children. And this is actually not a surprise. It could actually be based on real events that happened in ancient Egypt in the past, because we've got several plague locust species in Africa. And indeed, even recently, like in recent decades, we get plague locust swarms across Egypt. So this could actually be based on a real event, a real historical event.
And Theo, have we had, even in kind of recently recorded history, locust plagues so bad that they have really created serious famine for countries?
Probably not in the last, say, 2 decades or so, because our monitoring has become so good, and because both the insecticides and the fungus that we use to control the locusts have become so effective. So long as we can do the monitoring and catch them early enough, we can really minimize these plagues. So nothing of biblical standards in the last decade or two, but we still get some outbreaks, yes.
Yeah, but I'd imagine going back to if they ate every plant in Egypt, if something like that had happened, that would have been pretty serious trouble for the people involved. Theo, there are other mentions in the Bible of the locusts.
Yes, just quickly, also in the Old Testament, we have Joel, who uses locust plagues symbolically to represent the coming of the day of the Lord. In the New Testament, another sort of symbolic representation, John in the book of Revelations has this absolutely crazy vision of a star coming to earth, opening a pit, and then locusts coming out and terrorizing people like they are scorpions. All very weird. You'll have to get a biblical scholar on to try and explain the allegories. It's about sort of Satan coming to earth and releasing his demons and so on. But really the main point of all of these mentions is that locusts are terrible and they are sent to harm mankind. But there is an example in the Bible of locusts being good. And this is in Leviticus, the third book of the Bible. And Leviticus is full of rules about how to worship God, about the clothes you can wear and how you can dress, how you farm your land, and also all these food rules, you know, what the Israelites were allowed to eat and what they were not allowed to eat. And that's where we get, you know, the cleaving of the hoof and the chewing of the cud. And if an animal doesn't do those two things, you can't eat it. But locusts are one of the animals that are considered clean and that you were allowed to eat. And we see this also in the New Testament. John the Baptist, when he lived in the desert, ate honey and locusts for dinner.
Honey and locusts. Well, if I was going to eat a locust, I definitely want honey on it. Okay. So apart from the Bible, and we'll come back to locusts as food in a couple of minutes' time, apart from the Bible, do locusts appear in other ancient texts, Theo?
Yes, they do, quite a few. We have them in ancient Egypt. So the first ones are inscribed on the walls of pyramids. The second are found inscribed into coffins themselves. And the third one is in papyrus texts. And they're called the pyramid texts, the coffin texts, and the book of the dead. And these all do the same thing. They basically are spells or enchantments put on these places to protect the dead people in the afterlife from, you know, the wrath of the gods and so on. And they go back, the pyramid texts are the oldest, they go back to 2,500 years BC. So that's, you know, 4,500 years old. And a curious thing about the hieroglyph for locust, so it's a sort of a stylized image of a grasshopper, that means locust, but it also means a very big number. So, you know, if you were talking about a very big number of people, you would have that hieroglyph of locusts as well as the hieroglyph for people.
All right. Homer mentions the locusts as well.
Yes, Homer. So he's Greek. That's in the Iliad, his book about the fall of Troy. This is about 800 BC. And he uses it as a metaphor because the hero of the Greeks was Achilles. And he was an incredible fighter. He was a half god. And so Homer uses how locusts flee from fire. Remember, they live in arid lands and fire is a big deal in arid lands. And they all know what fire is and know fire isn't any good, so they all fly away from fire. And so he compared the soldiers of Troy fleeing the hero Achilles like locusts would flee a fire.
All right. Where else are they mentioned, Theo?
So in India, is another place with a lot of semi-arid subtropical land, and the Mahabharata is a very famous epic Sanskrit book that dates about 400 BC, and locusts are used as a metaphor, a destructive metaphor. So part of the story in the Mahabharata is fighting within a ruling family to see who could control a kingdom. And so when they're talking about the potential civil war, they say a civil war would be like the destruction wrought by locusts. It would destroy the country. So it was a warning not to go into civil war. And finally, we also have another mention in the Quran, the holy book of Islam, and that's from about 600 AD. And again, swarms of locusts are used as a metaphor for destruction, as a plague sent by God to punish nations who are being arrogant and sinful. So plague the same way it happened back in Exodus. But also interestingly, locusts are used as a metaphor for the resurrection of people when God returns to earth and so forth. So people emerging from the earth is a bit like locusts emerging from the earth in their huge numbers. So it's actually seen as a positive image in that case.
And Islam locusts are also considered halal, so food that you are allowed to eat. So Theo, let's talk about eating locusts today. Do we eat locusts today?
So they do. Some people do in certain parts of the world. They do eat insects. Insects are actually a good thing in many ways compared to mammals and birds that we mostly grow in sort of European-centric cultures, because insects have a really high feed conversion ratio. So you get more insects per amount of food that you feed them. So, for example, if you want to make 1 kilogram of an insect, say locusts or crickets, you need 2 kilograms of food. For chickens, it's 2.5, maybe a bit more kilos of food to get 1 kilo of chicken. And when you look at sheep and cattle, it's more like 10 kilos of food to make 1 kilo of beef or lamb. So if you're looking at it from a purely economic efficiency perspective, insects are much more efficient. And that has started to get people in sort of Western European-centric countries to think harder about, should we be growing insects with the food that we produce and use as food for our livestock? And there's a very young, nascent industry growing in Western countries about eating insects. And we, even in Australia, so obviously our Indigenous people, our First Nations people, have a long history of eating insects, such as witchetty grubs and bogong moths and the like. But recently, I think this was about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, the Australian government approved 3 insects for human consumption. And 2 of those are beetles, and 1 of them are crickets, which obviously are relatives of locusts. And so now it is perfectly legal in Australia, and there are companies that do this, to grow the insects and sell it as human food.
Okay. And is that having it dished up whole in a restaurant, or is it more likely the insect's going to be kind of ground up and used in some other way?
Yeah, so a few people do whole insects. I've seen chocolate-covered crickets advertised, but I think that's not very common. The main, you know, there's definitely a yuck factor. Most of us don't think, oh, a cricket, yummy. So you've got to kind of hide it. And it's really about getting protein into the diet, and you can hide them by grinding them up into a powder, and then you can add that powder into something else. So, for example, you could put it into bread and make the bread higher protein. You could add it into pasta, for example. You can mix it with flour and make pasta. Or you could put it in the sauce and it would become a thickening agent in the sauce, but it would also increase that protein. So it means you would get your daily dose of protein without having to eat as much, you know, beef or lamb or chicken, for example.
Have you eaten these insects, Theo?
I haven't actually eaten the powdered form. I've actually eaten the original form. So
what, the cricket and the beetles?
Yes, and I've also eaten honeybee pupae and silkworm pupae.
Wow. Okay. Which of those is your favourite?
Well, they were so heavily disguised in spicy sauces, it's a bit hard to actually
articulate what the taste even was, hey?
Yes. That's right.
Well, they were well disguised at any rate.
That's right.
Theo, thank you for yet another lesson in the wonderful world of bugs. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Suzanne.
Theo Evans is Associate Professor of Applied Entomology at the University of Western Australia.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.